Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. We're on lesson three today, infectious disease, sanitation, and hygiene. And I want to start with one stat from the module that I think is the right place to anchor.
Hit me.
For nearly all of human history, infectious disease was the dominant cause of death. Plague swept through populations periodically. Childbed fever killed roughly one mother in five. Childhood mortality from diarrheal and respiratory disease ran at 30 to 50% in many populations. And then between roughly 1850 and 1960, that just changed.
That 110-year transition is the largest single improvement in human welfare since the agricultural revolution.
That's the line, since the agricultural revolution, and almost everything in this lesson is a piece of how that happened.
Okay, four sections. The germ theory revolution, the sanitary revolution, vaccination from Jenner to mRNA, and then modern pandemics and antimicrobial resistance. That's a lot.
It is. And worth flagging, last lesson we talked about snow and miasma and how the institutional skeleton of modern public health got built before germ theory. This lesson is what happened when the science finally caught up with the policy.
Section one, germ theory. Pasteur, Koch, Lister, and Semmelweis, they're not collaborators.
Not at all. Different countries, different methods, different problems. But within roughly 30 years, between about 1860 and 1890, the collective work of these four men and their networks displaced a 2,000-year-old theoretical framework and replaced it with one we still use in elaborated form today.
Start with Pasteur.
Louis Pasteur, 1822 to 1895. And the thing to know about Pasteur is that he was trained as a chemist, not a physician, which is partly why he was able to see what physicians couldn't. His first major contributions were on molecular asymmetry in crystals and then on the chemistry of fermentation. Working on wine and beer spoilage, he came to the observation that specific microorganisms produce specific fermentation outcomes.
And the swan-necked flask experiment.
1864. He set up flasks with curved necks that trapped airborne particles while still allowing air exchange, the broth in those flasks remained sterile. Broth exposed directly to air spoiled. That experiment definitively disproved spontaneous generation. Microorganisms come from existing microorganisms. They're transmitted. They don't appear by magic from organic matter.
And he extended it to disease.
He worked on a silkworm disease called Pébrine that was devastating the French silk industry, showed it was caused by a specific microorganism, developed control methods, did the same for chicken cholera and anthrax. In 1881, he did a famous public demonstration at Pouilly-le-Fort, vaccinated sheep against anthrax with attenuated bacteria he'd cultured. The vaccinated sheep survived a live anthrax challenge. The unvaccinated controls died. International press, dignitaries, the whole thing.
And then Joseph Meister.
1885, Pasteur's most famous moment. A nine-year-old boy savagely bitten by a rabid dog. The vaccine Pasteur had developed in animals but never tested in humans was administered in increasingly potent doses over 14 days. Meister survived. The story electrified the public. The Pasteur Institute was founded in 1888 and is still operating in Paris and at sites worldwide. And of course, pasteurization, heat treating milk and other foods to kill harmful microorganisms, bears his name.
And then Koch?
Robert Koch, 1843 to 1910, German country doctor. Did laboratory work in his consulting room in his spare time that would change medicine. His first major paper in 1876 identified Bacillus anthracis as the cause of anthrax. First definitive demonstration that a specific bacterium caused a specific disease. He then identified the bacterial causes of tuberculosis in 1882 and cholera in 1884. His TB paper, presented to the Berlin Physiological Society on March 24, 1882, is one of the most consequential single scientific communications in history. TB at the time was killing roughly one in seven Europeans.
And Koch contributed tools, not just findings.
Right, this is important. He developed solid culture media, initially using gelatin and potato slices, eventually agar. Agar was suggested by Fanny Hesse, the wife of one of Koch's collaborators. Worth mentioning because the named credit goes to Koch, but the practical innovation came from elsewhere. He pioneered photomicroscopy of stained bacteria, making microbial identification reproducible and shareable, and he formulated Koch's postulates.
Walk us through those.
Four criteria a microorganism must meet to be considered the cause of a specific disease. One, the organism must be present in all cases of the disease. Two, it must be isolable in pure culture from a diseased host. 3, introducing the cultured organism into a healthy host must produce the disease. And 4, the organism must be re-isolable from the newly infected host.
And those postulates have been refined.
Substantially. The classical postulates don't fit several modern situations. Asymptomatic carriers, Helicobacter pylori is carried by about half the world's population, only a minority develop disease. Unculturable organisms. The syphilis spirochete wasn't successfully grown in long-term culture until 2018. Viruses don't fit because they require host cells. Prions don't even contain genetic material in the classical sense. So in 1988, Stanley Falkow proposed Molecular Koch's postulates that update the framework for the molecular era.
But the postulates are still taught.
Because the underlying logic is the basic structure of any causal inference about a specific agent. A claimed cause must be reliably present, isolable, capable of producing the disease, re-isolable. Teaching Koch's postulates teaches the discipline of asking, how would I know this caused the disease rather than just being associated with it? That question hasn't gone away.
Then Lister.
Joseph Lister, 1827 to 1912. British surgeon, Glasgow and then London. He read Pasteur's papers on fermentation in the 1860s and made an inferential leap. If microorganisms cause fermentation in liquids, maybe they also caused the infections that killed roughly 40 to 50% of post-surgical patients in mid-19th century hospitals.
Half of surgical patients dying of infection?
Half. Yeah. So Lister hypothesizes that preventing microorganisms from entering wounds would prevent post-surgical infection. He experiments with carbolic acid, phenol, which was known to control sewage odors and which he assumed acted on the relevant germs, develops a protocol, carbolic acid spraying of the operative field, soaking of dressings, antiseptic preparation of instruments and hands, published in The Lancet in 1867. Post-surgical mortality, in his words, dropped by maybe half.
And the technique spread.
Slowly at first, British surgeons were sometimes hostile to innovation from a Scottish provincial surgeon. Then rapidly, antiseptic surgery, killing microorganisms, it was later refined into aseptic surgery, maintaining sterile environments and instruments, which is the modern operating theater approach. The carbolic spray itself doesn't get used anymore. It was harsh on the patients and harder on the surgical team. But the underlying principle is the bedrock of all modern surgical practice.
And there's a really nice methodological point the module makes about Lister.
Yeah, the basic science was developed in one country in one discipline. The practical application was developed in another country in another discipline. And the global adoption took decades of advocacy, demonstration, and the death of older surgeons who refused to change their practice. That's a pattern that recurs in public health history. The mechanism by which scientific findings translate into clinical and public health practice is rarely fast and is always partly social and political.
Then Semmelweis, which is the one that's hardest to tell.
Yeah, this is the tragedy of being right too early. Ignaz Semmelweis, Hungarian obstetrician at Vienna General Hospital in the 1840s. 2 decades before Pasteur. Germ theory doesn't exist yet. He notices something his colleagues have been observing without explanation. The maternal mortality rate from puerperal fever, childbed fever, is approximately 18% in the wards staffed by physicians, but only 2% in the wards staffed by midwives.
A ninefold difference.
The disparity is so large that pregnant women in Vienna sometimes beg to be admitted to the midwife wards rather than the physician wards. Semmelweis investigates. The difference between the two wards is that physicians spend their mornings performing autopsies, including autopsies on women who died of puerperal fever, and then deliver babies, sometimes within minutes, without washing their hands. Midwives don't perform autopsies.
So in May 1847, he institutes the protocol.
Hand washing with chlorinated lime water between autopsies and deliveries. Maternal mortality on the physician wards drops from 18% to below 2%. Matches the midwife wards. He saved thousands of lives.
And the medical establishment rejected him.
Yeah, dismissed from Vienna General. Published work poorly received. The implication on that respectable physicians were killing patients through their own carelessness was unbearable to a profession that defined itself by competence and propriety. Semmelweis grew progressively more bitter, then erratic, then mentally ill. Committed to an asylum in 1865. Died there at age 47, beaten by guards, unrecognized at his death. His findings were vindicated only after germ theory provided a theoretical framework that explained why his protocol worked.
It's a hard story.
It's taught now as a parable about resistance to evidence in medicine. Semmelweis had the right answer. His evidence was strong. He was nonetheless ignored, mocked, ostracized. partly because he lacked the social skills to overcome professional resistance, partly because his findings indicted his colleagues. The lesson is uncomfortable. Being right is necessary, but not sufficient. And even strong evidence can fail to displace strong professional interests.
And modern hand hygiene in hospitals is still it's the same intervention.
Hospital-acquired infections, many of them caused by antibiotic-resistant organisms, kill an estimated 50 to 90,000 patients per year in North America. The basic interventions are unchanged from the 19th century. Wash your hands, sterilize your instruments, use barriers. The operational challenge of getting them done consistently, at scale, in busy clinical environments, is the active research and quality improvement frontier. The Semmelweis story shows up regularly in modern infection control training. Often with the moral, this could be us.
Okay, section two, the sanitary revolution.
And this is the move that I think the module wants students to really sit with. Before any vaccine, before any antibiotic, sanitation infrastructure did more to reduce infectious disease mortality than any clinical intervention in human history.
Bigger than antibiotics.
Bigger than antibiotics. The European and North American 19th century mortality decline, especially among children, is in large part a sanitary revolution story. It happened largely under wrong theoretical assumptions, miasma rather than germ theory, and produced effects that no amount of clinical medicine could match.
Pull the engineering thread.
Between roughly 1850 and 1920, every industrialized city built underground sewer networks, central water treatment plants, municipal garbage collection. London's modern sewer system was designed by Joseph Bazalgette after the Great Stink of 1858. When raw sewage in the Thames produced a smell so overwhelming that Parliament was nearly forced to relocate. The system Bazalgette built incorporates roughly 1,800 kilometers of street sewers and 132 kilometers of intercepting sewers carrying waste away from the city center, completed by 1875, still in use today.
And the public health impact.
Dramatic. London's cholera mortality, which had been measured in the tens of thousands during outbreaks in 1832, 1848 to 49, and 1853 to 54, dropped sharply after the sewer system was completed. Typhoid mortality fell similarly. Infant mortality from diarrheal disease, which had been the leading cause of child death in industrialized cities, declined steadily through the late 19th century. Toronto sewer expansions in the 1880s, Montreal's water filtration installations in the early 1900s, corresponding declines in typhoid and infant diarrheal mortality.
And yet, Bazalgette is barely known.
That's the puzzle. There's no Pasteur or Koch of sewerage. Bazalgette is barely known outside the UK. The reason is partly cultural. Sanitation infrastructure is invisible when it works. And partly institutional, sewers and water treatment are not owned by health agencies, they're owned by public works departments, which makes them disappear from health narratives. The result is that students often underestimate how much of population health is delivered by infrastructure rather than by clinical intervention.
The other arm was food safety.
Pasteurization of milk, heat treatment that kills tuberculosis bacilli, salmonella, listeria, E. coli, and many other pathogens without rendering the milk unpalatable. Championed by Nathan Strauss in New York in the 1890s. He owned Macy's, no formal public health credentials, but he was so convinced of the importance of pasteurized milk that he funded free pasteurized milk distribution to poor children in New York from 1893. Infant mortality in the area served dropped dramatically.
And then mandatory pasteurization.
Spread through the early 20th century, Chicago in 1908, New York in 1912, most Canadian provinces by the 1930s, the impact on bovine tuberculosis transmission to children alone was enormous. Childhood TB rates dropped by roughly 90% in jurisdictions that mandated pasteurization.
And there's a sub-debate in this section, the McKeown thesis.
Yeah, this is one of those debates that defined a generation of historical epidemiology. Thomas McKeown, in 1976, argued that the historical mortality decline was driven primarily by improved nutrition and living conditions, not by clinical medicine or even by sanitation specifically. The thesis was influential, partly because it embarrassed clinical medicine and partly because it elevated structural determinants. It's also been substantially modified. Simon Schreeder and others showed that sanitation specifically was underestimated by McKeown and that the timing of the decline tracked sanitation more closely than nutrition.
And the methodological lesson is...
Complex historical changes produce attribution problems that no single analytic technique can fully resolve. multiple line of evidence approaches, combining interrupted time series, comparative cross-national analysis, disease-specific decomposition, and mechanistic plausibilities are the standard. And the same methodological structure shapes debates today about what reduced cardiovascular mortality from the 60s onward. Was it clinical management of hypertension and cholesterol, smoking decline, dietary change, exercise, medical care, same kind of attribution problem?
And the lesson is honest that this story isn't done.
Globally, about 2 billion people lack safely managed drinking water. In Canada, long-term drinking water advisories on First Nations reserves are a continuing reality. The Trudeau government's 2015 commitment to end all of them by 2021 was missed. There's been substantial progress, but the problem persists, and the developed world sanitation infrastructure is aging. Much of it was built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Lead service lines remain in millions of older homes. The Flint, Michigan crisis from 2014 is a high-profile example. Combined sewer overflows during heavy rain are increasingly common with climate change.
The infrastructure renewal case is unambiguous. The political case is harder.
Always harder for invisible infrastructure than for visible interventions. Public goods are systematically undervalued in cultures that focus on individual interventions. That's a recurring theme in this course.
Okay, section 3, vaccination from Jenner to mRNA.
Vaccination is the only public health intervention that has ever eradicated a human disease. Its history spans more than 220 years. From Edward Jenner's 1796 observation that milkmaids who had had cowpox were protected against smallpox, through to the mRNA vaccine platforms deployed against COVID in 2020.
Start with Jenner.
The founding observation is rooted in folk medicine. By the late 18th century, dairy farmers and milkmaids in rural England had observed for generations that exposure to cowpox, a relatively mild disease that produced lesions on cows' udders and on the hands of milkers, appeared to protect against smallpox. Smallpox at the time was killing roughly 400,000 people per year in Europe alone, most cases in children. Survivors often left scarred or blind.
And there was already an earlier technique. Variolation.
Variolation, deliberately introducing material from a smallpox lesion into a healthy person to produce a mild case and subsequent immunity. Practiced for centuries in China, India, and the Ottoman Empire. Introduced to England in 1721 by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. It worked, but carried about 1 to 2% mortality and risk of starting new outbreaks.
Then Jenner?
Edward Jenner, country physician in Gloucestershire. In May 1796, he scratched material from a cowpox lesion, taken from a milkmaid named Sarah Nelmes, into the arm of an 8-year-old boy named James Phipps. Phipps developed a mild local reaction and a brief fever. 6 weeks later, Jenner deliberately exposed Phipps to material from a smallpox lesion. Phipps did not develop smallpox. Jenner repeated the experiment on additional subjects with consistent results and published in 1798, coined the term vaccination from the Latin vacca, cow.
And the ethical questions are worth flagging.
Yeah. Jenner's experimental ethics, deliberately exposing a child to smallpox without modern informed consent procedures with substantial risk of death, would not be acceptable today. The technique spread despite, not because of, the medical establishment, with significant lay support and equally significant lay resistance. Compulsory vaccination acts in 19th century Britain generated organized opposition. The Anti-Vaccination League was founded in 1853, anticipated the modern vaccine hesitancy movement in many ways.
Then the campaign that closed the loop, smallpox eradication.
The WHO smallpox eradication program was authorized by the World Health Assembly in 1959 and intensified in 1967 under the leadership of the American epidemiologist Donald Henderson. At program launch, smallpox was killing approximately 2 million people per year globally, with around 10 to 15 million cases annually. The eradication target seemed wildly ambitious. It worked.
The strategy combined two elements.
Mass vaccination, which increased population immunity in high prevalence regions, and the more innovative element, surveillance containment, or ring vaccination. When a case was identified, the response was to vaccinate every contact, every contact's contacts, and the surrounding community within a defined radius. The strategy was developed in the Nigerian and Indian portions of the campaign. It was vastly more efficient than blanket mass vaccination once cases became rare.
And there are two names in the endgame story.
The last endemic case of smallpox was Alimau Maleen, a 23-year-old hospital cook in Somalia, October 26, 1977. The last person to die of smallpox was Janet Parker, a British medical photographer who acquired the disease through a laboratory exposure in Birmingham in 1978. Smallpox was certified as eradicated on May 8, 1980.
And the campaign's cost relative to what it returned?
Approximately $300 million in 1967 dollars, roughly $2 billion in 2026 dollars. The ongoing avoided cost and lives in medical care and vaccine production that no longer happens is essentially unmeasurable but extraordinarily large. As a cost-effectiveness ratio, smallpox eradication is essentially unmatched in human history.
And the playbook is still in use.
Polio eradication has used analogous strategies. Polio has been pushed to fewer than 30 wild cases globally in 2024, down from about 350,000 cases in 1988. But the last reservoirs in Afghanistan and Pakistan are in conflict zones where vaccinators are killed, and the security infrastructure for eradication is fragile. Whether polio joins smallpox as eradicated is an open question.
Then the 20th century vaccine pipeline?
Between roughly 1920 and 2000, vaccines were developed for nearly every major childhood infectious disease that had been the dominant cause of childhood mortality a generation earlier. Diphtheria toxoid in 1923, pertussis 1926, tetanus toxoid 1924, combined DPT 1948. Yellow fever vaccine in 1937 became the first vaccine against a virus developed by Max Thieler, who won the Nobel Prize for it in 1951. Influenza vaccines have been produced annually since the 1940s.
And the polio vaccines.
The great mid-century achievement. Jonas Salk's inactivated polio vaccine, the IPV, was tested in one of the largest clinical trials ever conducted. 1.8 million children, 1954, and licensed in 1955. Albert Sabin's live attenuated oral polio vaccine, the OPV, was developed in parallel, tested initially in the Soviet Union, licensed in 1961. They have different profiles. Salk's is safer, but requires injection and produces less mucosal immunity. Sabin's is cheaper, orally administered, produces stronger mucosal immunity, but in rare cases, about 1 per 750,000 doses reverts to virulence and causes vaccine-derived polio.
Then MMR HPV.
MR, introduced in 1971, eliminated measles as a routine childhood illness in most high-income countries by the 80s. Measles mortality globally, about 6 million in 1970, reduced by roughly 95% by 2015. HPV vaccine, introduced in 2006, driving sharp declines in cervical cancer in countries with high uptake. Australia is on track to eliminate cervical cancer as a public health concern by 2030.
And none of these has been uncontested.
None. Pertussis, MMR, and HPV vaccines have all generated organized opposition. The big one was the 1998 Wakefield paper in The Lancet that falsely claimed an association between MMR vaccine and autism. We talked about this last lesson in the context of research misconduct. Retracted in 2010. Wakefield struck off the UK medical register. Subsequent studies of millions of children showed no association, but the damage to public confidence took longer to repair than the falsification took to publish, and the consequences continue.
Then mRNA, which the module characterizes as a 30-year overnight success.
That's exactly right. The mRNA platform deployed against COVID in late 2020 is sometimes described as a breakthrough technology developed in 2020. It is not. It's the product of 3 decades of largely unrewarded basic science, primarily by Katalin Karikó, the Hungarian-American biochemist, and her American collaborator, Drew Weissman, working primarily at the University of Pennsylvania from the 1990s onward.
What's the basic idea?
You deliver messenger RNA, the molecule that codes for a specific protein, into human cells, which then use the mRNA to produce the encoded protein and trigger an immune response. Theoretical advantages were enormous. Vaccines could be designed within days of identifying a target pathogen rather than the months or years a traditional vaccine takes. They could be manufactured at scale using standardized processes. They could, in principle, be applied to almost any infectious disease or cancer immunotherapy target.
And the obstacles?
Also enormous. mRNA is rapidly degraded by enzymes in the body. It triggers strong inflammatory responses that can be dangerous. Getting it into cells without destruction is non-trivial. Karikó and Weissman spent the better part of 2 decades solving these problems, often unable to attract funding, operating on the margins of academic legitimacy.
And then
SARS-CoV-2 was sequenced and shared globally on January 11, 2020. Moderna and BioNTech partnered with Pfizer, used the Karako-Weissman platform to design vaccine candidates within hours. Phase 1 trials began within weeks. Phase 3 efficacy data in November 2020. Emergency use authorization in December 2020. First mass vaccinations on December 8th in the UK, 14th in the US, shortly after in Canada and elsewhere. From genome to deployment was approximately 11 months. By far the fastest vaccine development in history. By the end of 2021, roughly 10 billion doses had been administered globally.
And Karako and Weissman won the 2023 Nobel for it.
Yeah, their decades of preparatory science made the speed of COVID vaccine deployment possible. The speed itself reflected a unique combination of basic science readiness, regulatory flexibility, manufacturing scale-up, and political will. mRNA platforms are now being applied to influenza, RSV, HIV, malaria, and a range of cancers. The technology is genuinely transformative. COVID deployment was a long-prepared overnight success.
Okay. Section 4, modern pandemics and antimicrobial resistance.
Every generation since 1900 has had at least one defining infectious disease event. Each has reshaped what public health does next.
Start with 1918.
1918 influenza pandemic, often called Spanish flu, a misnomer, it didn't originate in Spain, killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide between 1918 and 1920. Some estimates as high as 100 million, three waves. The second, autumn 1918, was the most lethal. The virus, later identified as a particularly virulent H1N1 influenza A subtype, was unusual in that it killed disproportionately healthy young adults, the W-shaped mortality curve, likely through a cytokine storm mechanism.
And the context limited the response.
World War I was in its final year, millions of soldiers moving between continents in conditions that facilitated spread. Public health infrastructure was rudimentary by modern standards, no antivirals, no vaccines. The influenza virus itself wasn't isolated until 1933, and the first flu vaccines came in the 40s. No respirators in the modern sense. Limited capacity to treat the secondary bacterial pneumonia that killed most of the dead.
And then the pandemic was forgotten.
With extraordinary speed. By the 1930s, it was rarely discussed publicly, even by people who had lived through it. The trauma of World War I may have absorbed much of the public memory. The disease was just flu in a way that didn't fit later narratives of conquerable diseases. And the forgetting shaped subsequent pandemic preparedness in a particular way. When SARS emerged in 2003 and H1N1 in 2009, public health officials had to argue from historical analogy with an event most people had never heard of. COVID-19 finally restored 1918 to public memory in many countries.
Then HIV.
First cases reported in the CDC's MMWR on June 5th, 1981. Five cases of pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in previously healthy gay men in Los Angeles. Within months, similar cases across the United States and in Europe. The syndrome was briefly called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, before broader case findings showed it affected hemophiliacs, injection drug users, blood transfusion recipients, and infants born to infected mothers. The virus we now call HIV was identified in 1983 to 84 by groups led by Luc Montagnier in Paris and Robert Gallo in the US in a long-running priority dispute eventually resolved by sharing credit.
And the first decade and a half was brutal.
From about 1981 to 1996, extraordinarily high mortality, limited treatment, average time from HIV infection to death without treatment was about 10 to 12 years. For those who developed AIDS-defining illnesses, life expectancy was typically 1 to 3 years. AZT was the first antiretroviral introduced in 1987, used as monotherapy, substantial toxicity, rapid resistance.
The political response was disastrously slow.
In the US, President Reagan didn't publicly speak the word AIDS until 1985, 4 years and tens of thousands of deaths into the pandemic.
Then the 1996 transformation.
Highly active antiretroviral therapy, HAART. Combinations of three or more antiretroviral drugs that suppressed viral replication and prevented resistance emergence. The shift from monotherapy to combination therapy was driven in substantial part by activist pressure on regulatory agencies. People with HIV who responded to HAART went from preparing to die to planning long lives.
and then U equals U.
By 2008, the Swiss Federal Commission for HIV/AIDS could announce, and by 2016, this was global consensus, that U equals U. A person with HIV on effective treatment with sustained undetectable viral load does not transmit HIV sexually. HIV is now, in countries with adequate treatment access, a chronic manageable condition with near normal life expectancy.
And ACT UP shaped how research and regulation worked.
ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, founded in 1987 by Larry Kramer and others, direct action protest, public confrontation of researchers, policy advocacy, forced changes in how clinical trials were conducted, how drugs were approved, how treatment access was structured. The phrase, nothing about us without us, borrowed from disability rights and now standard in patient-oriented research, traces in part to ACT UP. The contemporary structure of community-based participatory research owes a lot to this period.
Then SARS, H1N1, Ebola.
The rehearsal years, SARS in 2003 was the first big one, severe acute respiratory syndrome, emerged in southern China in late 2002. International spread rapidly through air travel to Hong Kong, Toronto, Singapore. Toronto's outbreak was particularly severe, but 44 deaths in two waves, substantial healthcare worker infections, partial shutdown of the city's hospital system, killed about 800 people globally, infected around 8,000, contained through aggressive case identification, isolation, contact tracing. Outbreak ended in mid-2003. SARS-CoV-1 has not been detected in humans since.
And we covered last lesson. The institutional consequence in Canada was PHAC.
Right, Naylor Report, PHAC, created in 2004. The lessons of SARS were not fully implemented before COVID hit. Recurring pattern of post-outbreak commitments fading with time. H1N1 in 2009 was a moderate severity pandemic that tested the post-SARS preparedness plans, mortality lower than feared. But the pandemic exposed the fragility of global vaccine supply chains and the difficulty of producing pandemic vaccines on the timescale required. Most countries' H1N1 vaccines arrived after the peak of disease activity. Reshaped pandemic planning towards stockpiling, faster regulatory pathways, and the rapid vaccine technologies that would prove decisive in 2020. Ebola in 2014 to 16 was the largest in history, over 28,000 cases, about 11,000 deaths in West Africa. The WHO declared a public health emergency of international concern only in August 2014, months after substantial spread. Reform attempt followed, wasn't fully implemented when COVID emerged.
Then COVID.
Largest single public health event of the past century outside wartime. As of late 2025, official global death counts are approximately 7 million. Excess mortality analyses suggest the true toll is 20 to 25 million. The economic, social, educational disruption is impossible to summarize briefly. The scientific response was extraordinary. The public health response was variable. Some jurisdictions achieved remarkable containment, parts of East Asia, New Zealand, Australia early in the pandemic. Others experienced sustained high mortality. Lessons are still being processed.
And while COVID occupied attention, the slow pandemic kept growing.
Antimicrobial resistance. AMR, modeling estimates suggest AMR was associated with approximately 4.95 million deaths globally in 2019. More than HIV/AIDS at its peak, the AMR threat is structural. Antibiotics, like all infectious disease therapeutics, exert selection pressure that favors resistant organisms. Resistance has been observed for essentially every antibiotic ever introduced. New antibiotic development is slow and economically unattractive to pharmaceutical companies.
And the political problem AMR poses is different.
Unlike COVID, AMR has no event horizon, kills more people per year than COVID did in most years. But the deaths are dispersed across hospitals and care homes, individually attributed to other diagnoses, sepsis from an untreatable infection rather than AMR death, not connected to a salient cause. Political action requires a politically legible event. Slow pandemics are illegible to most political systems. The public health problems most likely to be addressed are not necessarily the largest, but the most visible.
Let me try to pull this together. 8 quick takeaways.
Cool.
First, germ theory between roughly 1860 and 1890 displaced 2,000 years of dominant theoretical frameworks in a single generation. Pasteur, Koch, Lister, and Semmelweis, who had the right answer too early and paid for it.
Second, Koch's postulates remain the basic structure of causal inference about a specific agent, even where the classical version doesn't apply directly. the discipline of asking, how would I know this caused the disease rather than just being associated with it, is still the right discipline.
Third, sanitation infrastructure did more to reduce infectious disease mortality than any clinical intervention in history, bigger than antibiotics, bigger than vaccines for many diseases. But it gets less attention than visible interventions because invisible infrastructure systematically gets undervalued. The work is incomplete globally and in Canada.
Fourth, vaccination is the only public health intervention that has eradicated a human disease. The WHO smallpox eradication program combined mass vaccination with surveillance containment, ring vaccination, and is the most cost-effective public health intervention in human history.
Fifth, the 20th century vaccine pipeline addressed nearly every major childhood infectious disease. None was uncontested. The 1998 Wakefield paper damaged public confidence in ways that persist.
Sixth, mRNA platforms are a 30-year overnight success. Carco and Weissman did the basic science from the 90s on. COVID deployment in 11 months was the fastest in history because the platform was ready when the genome arrived.
Seventh, the four pandemics of the past century, 1918, HIV, SARS, COVID, each reshaped what public health does next. The 1918 lesson was forgotten too fast. HIV transformed the relationship between research, regulators, and affected communities. SARS gave us PHAC. COVID's lessons are still being processed.
And eighth, antimicrobial resistance kills more people per year than most of the pandemics we remember by name. But it's invisible. Slow pandemics are legible to political systems. Whether we'll address it before it becomes a crisis like the others is one of the open questions of the next two decades.
And the capstone milestone this week, students trace their topic's communicability or its founding discovery moment.
Even non-infectious topics have a germ theory moment, a discovery that turned them from background suffering into a tractable public health problem. Find yours and name the institution that owns the surveillance.
Next lesson, we shift from infectious to chronic. Nutrition, physical activity, and sleep. The behavioral side of chronic disease. That's lesson four.
Read the module. Bring the questions that didn't resolve to class.
Thanks for listening. See you in lesson four.
Take care of yourselves. See you in class.